1865 until 1968, mental health care throughout the southern states was segregated by race. And Central State, which I guess that was the name around 1900, became pretty much the leader of how to manage mental health problems in African Americans throughout all of the southern states.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health. You are listening to Into the Fold, the Hogg Foundation podcast. The Hogg Foundation is a Texas-based mental health grant-making foundation and part of the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about the history of the foundation, our numerous grant programs, and some of the the new initiatives that we're launching with the hopes of broadening our impact on the mental health landscape, visit us at www.hogg.utexas.edu. So today I am most excited. I was finally able to get Dr. King Davis, a former Hogg Foundation Executive Director from 2003 to 2008. I have been looking forward to this conversation for a really long time. King Davis is a professor of research in the School of Information and also professor emeritus in African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Just two of the hats that he wears. And throughout his career, he's made exceptional contributions in the field of mental health, with a focus in particular on the intersections of race and mental health and social policy. So much of what the Hogg Foundation does now in the area of eliminating disparities, the provision of culturally competent mental health services, kind of bears his imprint. So from 2000 to 2014, he held the Robert Lee Sutherland Chair in Mental Health and Social Policy at the UT Austin School of Social Work. And one other thing, since he relocated, moved to Virginia, he's been heading up a really monumental effort to digitally preserve patient records from the segregation era. What was once known as the Central Lunatic Asylum for Colored Insane, now Central State Hospital, and I was hoping that I could just ask him a few questions about that, the significance of that project, and how it is that he came to head it up. So, Dr. King Davis, thanks so much for joining us.
Ike, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm delighted to be back at Hogg and delighted to have an opportunity to join you in this program.
So let's just start with the very recent past. Just yesterday, here in Austin, you gave a lecture at the UT, the School of Social Work, as part of its Dean Jack Otis Social Problem and Social Policy Lecture Series. I'm sorry that I couldn't be there. The title of your talk was New Directions, Bringing Policy Change in the Post-Obama Era. And so I was just hoping that you might summarize for us the high points of your lecture and what's been on your mind recently on that subject.
Okay. What the lecture attempted to do was to explain part of the policy stagnation that the United States has undergone in the last 8 years, most of the Obama administration period. And what I was asked to do by the committee that invited me, that put together the Otis lecture for this year, was to really grapple with this. Why have we been having such a difficult time getting policies passed? One example of that is the Affordable Care Act, which has been, I guess an effort has been made to rescind it by the Congress over 50 times, 50 votes to rescind it, as though there's something about this particular policy that is just abhorrent. Well, when you go back through the policy history of the Affordable Care Act, it really reflects an ongoing debate in the United States starting in 1912 to get some kind of near universal health care law passed. But from about 1912 until the Obama administration, nothing has been successful. We've been virtually frozen with our ability to get anything done. part of the reason for that has been that any effort to get health care on a more universal basis has been labeled as being socialist. When you look at the actual content of the Affordable Care Act, and I used to use the Affordable Care Act as the text for my classes here when I was here, all 1,000 pages of it. And part of what you find in it is that it's a watered-down version of the Massachusetts health care law that was Republican-based.
Yeah.
So when you look at that and you raise the question of if that's the case, why has it been an effort 50 times plus by the Congress to rescind it? And you have to then raise the question of whether or not there's a connection between President Obama and the Congress and the health care bill. And so my lecture yesterday was really designed to try to identify four or five things that have occurred over the course of the last 8 years or more that helped to explain this policy stagnation. So what I did in the lecture was to go back to the beginning of the 21st century in 2000 and to identify five, up to 10 factors, 10 variables, 10 events that helped to explain why we've had such difficulty, and then to project a little bit into 2017 when Obama is no longer the president of the United States.
Okay. And so about that, I mean, I could probably say at least a few things mm-hmm. about, you know, and from my, let's just call it existentially remote location
mm-hmm.
From where I sit and kind of look at, the political goings-on in this country.
Right.
And I'm often struck by just the sheer level of sclerosis mm-hmm. when it comes to, policy change mm-hmm. at the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about that, I mean, like, so what are, like, the two or three things that jump out at you as being, you know, most remarkable about the political moment that we're in?
Well, I cited a number of things, but some stood out more than others. And one of the things I wanted to do was to try to draw and develop a context. And the first part of that context was, how did we enter the 21st century? And I think we entered the 21st century with the greatest amount of fear than probably the United States has had since the turn of the 20th century with the Industrial Revolution. And it was principally because no one assumed or believed that we would be able to smoothly enter the 21st century without having all of our computers fail. The notion was we wouldn't be able to move from 1999 to 2000 without calamities. So I think the underbelly of the 21st century has been a tremendous amount of fear, just from that one factor alone. The second one of those that I cited was the changes in the racial demographics of the United States. The fear that people like Pat Buchanan and other conservative writers have talked about, that the Mexicans coming across the border and Africans and Asians and their high birth rates were all going to result in the traditional white population in the United States being overwhelmed in the American culture qua English culture or German culture or British culture. Buchanan also talks about the fact that the United States is going to be a minority-majority population by 2040. So there's been this groundswell of anti-immigrant kind of feeling as a result of that. I think that also flooded over into Obama, who was at the same time simultaneously considered to be a Muslim, a socialist, a communist, a thug, unintelligent, all kinds of things that were there. So this all comes from, I think, these feelings and fears that were articulated first by Pat Buchanan, but then they were picked up by what I call radical talk radio, radical talk television, and lots of other areas, but particularly in the southern states, where folks were particularly concerned that rather than this being, that is, Obama's election being some sign that America was in a post-racial society, what it raised was all of these notions that an incompetent, unable, other non-American was going to come in and crush American exceptionalism.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of what was there was this kind of feeling and material. One of the things that I find extraordinary, though, is that there's a writer named Draper. And Draper documents that on the night of Obama's inauguration, a group of Republican congressmen, senators and others met to really determine how they were going to make sure that Obama failed. Noted senators, noted congressmen, and Newt Gingrich as well, former congressman, was there. And they talked about building together a level of extreme opposition to ensure that nothing that Obama proposed would be successful, including appointments to head cabinet offices, anything at all. And we see that, I think, reflected now in the discussions and the debates over his nomination to the Supreme Court. But there are lots of other areas as well. So I think a lot of the policy stagnation really comes back to these notions of Obama being an illegitimate president, not the president of the United States and all of its population. And this fear that I think persons like Pat Buchanan and others have stimulated that Obama was going to do these ill things to the United States and its history.
Okay. Yeah, and what's particularly, I think, you know, striking about that is what seems obvious once you contrast all of the discourses mm-hmm. swirling around President Obama mm-hmm. with who he actually seems to be.
Yes.
This very moderate, mm-hmm. I guess, constitutionally cautious,
yes.
consensus-driven politician.
Mm-hmm.
And for myself, and who very frankly, you know, tends much further to the left, mm-hmm. it's both striking how often it is mm-hmm. that I find myself, you know, riding to Obama's defense almost
sure.
as if he were the you know, the radical mm-hmm. that he's often portrayed as being.
Yes. Yeah. On the other side of that as well, there's a lot of discussion. You hear this in the campaign today, the dog whistle campaign, as we call it,
yeah.
that the United States is in such terrible shape. Well, actually, Obama's economic program since he was elected is better than Reagan's, better than Bush 1, better than Clinton, and better than Bush 2. And if you look at just in the area of job development alone, where he started in 2008 at the beginning of his administration until now, is the largest and the longest growth in jobs in the United States, probably for 60 years. So when you juxtapose all of these notions that he was going to be a failed president, he has not been. And yet, the country's sense and feeling is that, on some instances, people are extraordinarily angry. Well, in a recent New York Times article and a recent Harper's Magazine article, part of what's discussed is that when measured in what's called the general survey, Americans feel pretty good about where they are. The anger comes from a group of older Southern white males who feel that they have been deceived relative to policy by the Republican Party. And it's the warring factions within the Republican Party itself, the Freedom Caucus, the Tea Party, lots of persons within the party that have created kind of a public myth that the nation is in dire straits when it really is not.
Yeah. So I thought that we might move to the Central State Hospital
sure.
project, and we can always circle back to
sure.
anything else that you'd like to
sure.
talk about, whatever you think might be germane to anything else.
Okay.
So just to reiterate, I had a previous conversation with Pat Galloway, mm-hmm. one of your close collaborators on the project. Mm-hmm. In talking to her, and again, what it is this monumental effort to transform this trove of records from the time of segregation at this particular institution.
Mm-hmm.
into a publicly accessible archive. And one thing that she seems to keenly understand, and I'm sure that you do too, is just all of the rather profound implications of long-term preservation, and also this sense that it really is a community archive. And so looping in all of the key stakeholders involved is kind of crucial.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you could just give me, from your perspective, just a general overview of the project, what it entails and how it is that you came to be involved with it.
Okay. To do that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the context as well.
Sure.
The context of policy.
Sure.
And I'll take you back to 1765. It's really important to see the context. In 1765, the state of Virginia opened the first mental institution in the United States called the Eastern Lunatic Asylum, located in Williamsburg. And they developed that because there was a lot of concern on the part of people within the press and the public that persons who had lunacy were adrift in the community and committing crimes. There was a particular case of an elderly woman who had been killed brutally, they said, by one of her neighbors, and it appeared in the Williamsburg Gazette in 1862, 1863. And as a result of that, there was a call for institutions similar to what was already in existence in Europe that would then protect the general public. So that first hospital at Williamsburg, the Eastern Lunatic Asylum, was the first one in the United States. But there was a provision in the Virginia policy or the Virginia law that said no slaves or people of color could be admitted to this first institution, regardless of their particular need for mental health care. There was also, during that period of time, a proposal by mental health professionals, doctors of the era, that slaves were, in fact, immune from problems of mental illness. And the reason that I like to talk about the context is that the policy of exclusion from this first hospital was based on the supposition that African people enslaved had a built-in immunity from mental illness. And the reason for it, the explanation was, because they were not involved in commerce, buying, selling, owning property and the like, there was no stress. So one of the earlier debates in Virginia was over whether or not slaves were exempt in some magical way from stress. The only persons who were at risk of mental illness in this first era were white male landowners. So that was the beginning. Soon after, about 1780 or so, the policy in Virginia changed to allow free Africans to be admitted to the hospital in the basement as long as it didn't displace any white person who was in need of care. So that's how we started. By 1840, when the first mental health director's superintendent's meeting actually took place, there was a lot of concern about the extent of mental illness in slaves. So there was a lot of rumbling about, one, freeing all slaves from bondage, and on the second part, what to do about those slaves who were currently having mental health problems. So Eastern Lunatic Asylum's director, named Galt, Galt decided that his particular hospital would in fact open its doors to both freedmen and slaves because he felt that integration could in fact work in a mental health context. On the other side of Virginia, one of the second hospitals to open was the Western Lunatic Asylum. It was considered to be the blue stocking hospital in the state. Only persons of significant economic means were going to be admitted to Western. And its director was an older, well-known, politically connected director. The director at Eastern State, John Galt, was new, relatively young, and not very well connected. So there was this debate that carried on for a number of years between Galt and Stribling, the director at Western, over integration versus segregation. So Stribling won. Stribling won the debate. So from 1840 until 1863, 1865, Eastern State was the only place where a small number of Africans could in fact be housed, and it was less than 100 from 1765 until 1865, maybe one a year was admitted. The 1840 census was also critical. The 1840 census was critical in determining what was going to happen in the future, because the 1840 census was the first one that identified individuals in institutions. And out of that first 1840 national census, was another sort of proposal or hypothesis that was put forward, and that was living in the South was better for the mental health of Africans in the United States than going north. And they had some data in there that suggested the further north black Americans went, the greater the probability that was that they would develop mental illness. And so this sort of notion was that freedom was not in the best interest of black people. And that's pretty much the way it went until near the end of slavery, when stribling from Western state influenced, in part, the Virginia legislature. But also, the Freedmen's Bureau entered, and they said that after the end of slavery, there were hundreds and hundreds of slaves in Virginia who lacked both health care and mental health care. So the Freedmen's Bureau took over an old Confederate hospital called Howard's Grove, located right on the fringe of Richmond, Virginia. And they converted that into a hospital for newly freed slaves. And as part of that, they then expanded it to offer mental health service as well. From 1865 until 1867, 1868, this hospital was operated by the Freedmen's Bureau out of Washington, D.C. Negotiations started around 1868 with the Commonwealth of Virginia. And in 1870, the new governor of Virginia agreed to transfer control of that hospital to the Commonwealth of Virginia. And it was then called the Central Lunatic Asylum for the Colored Insane. The governor provided the land. He had been the former mayor of Petersburg, Virginia. He secured $50,000 from the legislature, not the legislature, but the council in Petersburg, purchased a 385-acre farm, and that was the beginning of the Central Lunatic Asylum for the Colored Insane, and also the true beginning of segregated mental health care throughout the southern states. So from 1865 until 1968, mental health care throughout the southern states was segregated by race. And Central State, which I guess that was the name around 1900, became pretty much the leader of how to manage mental health problems in African Americans throughout all of the southern states. Unlike the rest of the southern states, the staff at Central kept every scrap of paper, every record, everything about the people that they served, but they kept them in an unarchived environment. And they accumulated 800,000 plus records. I think we're probably at 1.5 million records. Thousands of photographs, lots of negative slides, newspaper articles, you name it, it was all there. In 2006, I believe it was, I received a call from the director of Central State Hospital. And his administrative director was also on the line. And part of what they talked about was a recent visit that had been made to the hospital by the Library of Virginia's staff members. The Library of Virginia, under the Virginia law, is the repository of all archivable materials in the state, regardless of the agency. When I was mental health commissioner in Virginia, part of what we always knew was that we had warehouses that were literally filled with old records. You couldn't destroy them. So I had to rent space in the greater Richmond area and in some other areas to store records. And it was very expensive. We spent thousands and thousands of dollars storing records. The law basically suggested and required anytime the Commonwealth of Virginia's mental health system wanted to do something about an old record, they had to get the approval of the Library of Virginia. The Library of Virginia could say, destroy it, send it to us, or file it away and keep it for whatever reasons. Apparently, the staff at Central State, after the visit by the staff member from the Library of Virginia, interpreted that visit as indicating that their records were going to be confiscated and destroyed. That was the gist of the phone call. And because I had been commissioner and been director of mental health there for a number of years, I was asked whether or not there was something that I could do to prevent the destruction of the records that they had kept so well from 1865. I flew to Virginia probably 3 days later. I met with staff at the hospital. I looked over the records. They were everywhere. And many of them were still in daily use. Handwritten records, handwritten books. I mean, just extraordinary materials. And it appeared as though they were comparatively complete from 1865. So I then met with the Library of Virginia's director. I met with members of the legislature. I met with members of the Attorney General's office and others to see whether or not the interpretation by the folks at Central State was actually accurate. There was a person in the Department of Mental Health who had also visited the hospital, and her assessment was that the records from this first black hospital of this kind in the world were not worth keeping. So she agreed that at any point that the records were confiscated by the library, they should in fact be shredded. I then met with the new commissioner of the department and lots of other people, and we reached an agreement that if I could find funding to digitize the records, they would give me sort of a grace period, a year, 2 years, 3 years, after which the records would all then be turned over to the Library of Virginia and perhaps destroyed. I met with members of the Attorney General's staff who I had worked with when I was in the Department of Mental Health, and all of us agreed that the interpretation of the statute was not correct. Even though the library had the authority and the right to destroy records, there probably was never any intent on their part to destroy the records. I think there was a misinterpretation and a reflection of the tense relationships between this all-black hospital over the course of 100 years. Their budget was always less per capita than the four or five other predominantly white hospitals in the state. They never felt that they had gained much attention from the Department of Mental Health over the years. They didn't feel that they had been provided fair treatment in the Virginia legislature, so they were a bit cautious. And they interpreted these visits and interest on the part of the library as just another indicator of how race played a significant factor in the way that they were treated. So the Library of Virginia agreed with me that the records would be digitized, they would be preserved, and at the end of our digital project, we would then turn the records over to the state library. We initially got a $75,000 grant from NASHBIT, the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. The money was actually routed through SAMHSA, Substance Abuse Mental Health Administration, routed through NASHBIT, and then routed to us at the University of Texas at Austin. We then contracted with a group in Fredericksburg, Maryland, extraordinary group of digital file producers. And we had been given their name by the Library of Virginia. And we started carting off materials back and forth between Richmond and Fredericksburg, Maryland, to actually digitize the records. We then got $50,000 from the president of the University of Texas at Austin to add to that $75,000 to make it possible for us to start the digitization process. So from 2007, probably to 2012, that's what we did. We digitized approximately 800,000 records. And that's how we got into this business.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I've been wondering about the current state of the archive, mm-hmm. and how publicly accessible it is at this point.
Not near public accessible at this point. And that's because last year, 2015, we had written a grant around latter part of 2014 to the Andrew Mellon Foundation in New York. We had completed the digitization, but we really were not in a position to do very much with the materials that we had actually accumulated. And one of the issues that had come up that we did not anticipate to this extent was privacy.
Right.
Who should have access to these records, and under what conditions should they have access? Should any relative? Should the newspaper? Should the television? Should just anybody off the street be able to access the records? Because our original intent was to put them all online, just as has been done by Amazon, or is it Amazon? No, Ancestry.com. So we said, no, we don't really want to do that. So we held a privacy roundtable in Richmond in 2012.
We invited some of the chief archivists in the country. We invited archivists slash attorneys. We invited John Petrillo, who had been the legal counsel for the state of New York. We invited members of the Attorney General's staff in Richmond. We invited historians. We invited computer engineers. We invited the human rights people. We invited family members. We invited the Historical Society to all come together in Richmond, and let's talk about privacy. Who might have access to the records? What might they be looking for? What does the law say? If we were to open up records, under what conditions do we do that? Should records be online? Or should it be like a regular library where people have to go to the hospital to be able to access records? Should there be some credentialing process that's done like at the Library of Congress? So we met for 2.5 days. And that 2.5 day period really suggested to us what we needed to do was to have another grant program. So we applied to the Andrew Mellon Foundation with the basis of the proposal being, we're going to solve this problem of greater access to families and scholars and balance that with privacy, whether that's HIPAA, whether that's IRBs that universities use, whether that's the ethical requirements of our disciplines and professions, excuse me, or whether or not that's the Virginia law. So that became the basis under which we have now been in operation since 2015. We have a $763,000 grant that goes from 2015 to 2018. And our intent is to resolve this problem of access versus privacy. We have surveyed all of the mental health agencies in the country, all of the public ones. We're surveying all of the archival organizations in the country, all 51 of them. We have a survey that's being applied to family members. We have a survey that's going to be applied to scholars. What would you want if you were a scholar? And we think that that will allow us to be able to talk about how we manage it. The technological problem is fascinating because part of what we understood and learned from our roundtable was that we ought to create a technological computer way of not only credentialing particular users, but of accessing not records using redaction, but of a computerized process that eliminates all personal pronouns.
Yeah, like a. And Pat Galloway said some things about this.
It's
basically a digital overlay.
Yes.
That blacks out, you know, the data fields that you want to redact.
Based on who it is that's seeking access.
Right.
So if I'm a newspaper writer and I said, well, I'd really like to look at the records from 1865 to 1870, which are in the public domain, by the way, once that person is credentialed, certain parts of the records are not available.
Right.
Which is a marvelous, marvelous way to do it. Anmol Karadkar on this campus is the computer genius that's really working on that part of the problem. Pat Galloway and members of her staff, some postdocs, are working on the family, the ethical aspects of it. And I'm working on the data that looks at the first 5,000 admissions. Who were they? What do they look like? Where did they come from? What do we know about this first 5,000 persons who admitted? And we've now completed that part. But to go back to your question, none of that data that we've created so far is in the public domain. But family members have, under the law, access to the records of their relatives. So as I get calls or people contact us via email or other mechanisms, we give them the name of the persons at Central State Hospital that will allow them to come to the hospital and access their records.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, you know, nobody considers any lunatic asylum to be any ideal place to end up at.
Right.
Either now, certainly not in infindicycle, segregated Virginia. So I wonder, you know, to what extent you can actually, you know, create a slice of life from some of the records that you've come across. Or gain an appreciation of what day-to-day life might have been like for either the patients or the staff.
Absolutely. We've already started that. We know who was there when they came, why they came. There were 220 diagnoses that were applied to this first 5,000 persons who were there. We know how many died. We know generally what they died of. We know what their diagnoses were, at least as portrayed by the hospital people at the time period. We know how long they stayed. We know what their marital circumstances were like, what their education circumstances were like. We know a bit about their family structures as well. We know whether they were married, whether they were single. We know whether they had children or not. And I can read through, which I have, I can read through their records. Some of the records are 20 folders in length. So we have a very good sense of what persons were like who were admitted to this hospital. I know who the first person was who was admitted, and I know who the 5,000th person was who admitted. And I can tell you, by looking at the first 5,000 admissions, how many times that person came back from 1865 until 1902. But we also have a very clear sense of the nature of part of the day-to-day life of people who were there. There's something special about the people who came there and the people who worked there that allowed every piece of paper about every person who was admitted to be maintained, and maintained in such a way that it's all legible and, for the most part, pretty much intact. I project on my wall in my office data from the first persons who admitted. The first time I looked at those, I was tearful because it talked about why the person was admitted. And the causes of admission range, for the most part, I think it's 68% of the people were admitted because of suspected psychosis. But people were admitted for lots of other reasons as well. They didn't get along with their employer. They sassed a policeman. Someone refused to get off a sidewalk when some white person was passing by. The person was a vagrant. The person had a drinking problem. Lots and lots and lots of reasons. The reason other than psychosis was what they call religious excitement. And a significant number of these earlier admissions were for this vague category called religious excitement. So yes, we have a very good feel for what day-to-day life there was like. We know how many pounds of potatoes were grown. We know how many cabbage patches were tended to, how many cows they had, and who tended to all of that. We know how many dresses were made by the patients for the persons who were within the hospital. We also know how much entertainment they had. Up through the 1940s, we have pictures of some extraordinary entertainers who were there. I have these photographs of Louis Armstrong that no one's ever seen outside of the hospital. Lena Horne, who was there. Lots of different artists who came. So it's an extraordinary database. It's the most complete database of any population of African Americans with purported problems of mental illness in the United States. I have visited every southern state. I've tried to identify the records that are available in all of those states. I've gone into closed down former black hospitals. In one state, where when the hospitals are required by law to integrate, they left the vintage records in the hospital. It's been closed for over 45 years. But the back door is open because this hospital became the place that youngsters in the community came on Halloween. So records are everywhere. They're strewn all over the floor. They're mildewed. They're soaking wet. So the Virginia records from this hospital are exceptional. They truly are extraordinary in terms of the history of mental health care in the United States, and they tell a story. Part of that story I'm writing in my book. I've got 2 chapters out of 7 that I've already completed, and with each chapter, part of what I'm starting with is a brief story, a vignette of a person, starting with the very first person who was admitted to this hospital in 1866.
Okay. Yeah. And one thing that I came to appreciate in my conversation with Pat Galloway, mm-hmm. and more since then, mm-hmm. Is that in many ways the care that, and we're assuming those who legitimately had mental illness, mm-hmm. that they would have received then really in some ways did represent the state of the art,
yes.
for the time period.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because one thing that I've also come to appreciate in the few years that I've been here at the mm-hmm. Hogg Foundation mm-hmm. is how it's always been a struggle to find well-funded alternatives to institutional care.
Yes.
And so I think that really should temper us in passing judgment on what people did in the past.
Mm-hmm. Sure. There was one distinction, though. And the distinction when you juxtapose Eastern Lunatic Asylum, Western Lunatic Asylum, and Central Lunatic Asylum is work. The persons of color who were admitted to Central from 1865 forward the primary service, the primary treatment program included work.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because as part of the ideas about mental illness in African-American people was that work was the medium that would bring them back and restore them, help them to recover. And this notion about work went so far as to have persons from Central State travel to Eastern State to work almost in an orderly capacity as ward technicians for whites who were there.
Really?
So that's part of what the records also reveal, how much the workers in Central State who were actually patients in that hospital did part of the cleaning, they did the shoe repair, they did the making of dresses, they did much of the work with on the grounds with animals and farming and all of those kinds of things. Based on this notion that you tried, this is sort of the psychiatric notion, you try to find the kind of medium that was reflective of the person's ongoing life prior to the hospital. And so when you look at the records that we've been able to accumulate, the greatest majority of people who were admitted to the Central Lunatic Asylum were laborers. And so the idea was to put them back into some laboring capacity where they would feel comfortable and that might add to their recovery.
Okay. And so getting back to this notion of a community archive,
mm-hmm.
maybe the most important set of stakeholders is descendants. Mm-hmm. And you alluded to that, to how it is that that you're getting fairly frequent requests for assistance in information retrieval about patients. So I was wondering if you had any you know, memorable circumstances of that kind that you'd like to share with us.
Sure. I did not anticipate this part of this project. I didn't think, one, that the knowledge of our project would result in people calling us on the phone here at the University of Texas at Austin, or finding our email addresses and contacting us, or going through the newspaper to get in contact with us. Since the project was funded by the Mellon Foundation last year, and we're just ending our first year this month, I think I've received well over 150 calls or contacts from relatives. And because the hospital was the only one up through the end of the segregated era in 1968 to accept African-American patients, everybody of color who had a mental health issue had to come to this one particular facility. So we've gotten calls from psychiatrists who had a relative there, psychologists, lots of different people. And the calls stand out in lots of different ways. The one that I was sharing with you earlier that stands out most emotionally for me is from a woman who was born about 1953, and she claims, and I think it's true, that she was actually born in the hospital, in Central State Hospital. And she indicates that she had a twin brother who was born at the same time. Her mother was a patient. I'm not clear whether the pregnancy occurred while she was in the hospital or prior to. But she said that soon after her birth, she was adopted out by her relatives in West Virginia or Maryland, one of those states. But she doesn't know what happened to her brother. And so she said she's been looking for her lost brother for probably 20 years or so, unable to find out what happened to her brother. So part of what she was asking was, using this database, is it possible for us to help her find out what occurred and what happened to her brother? Well, at this point, I can't. But it's likely that in our exploration, we're going to be able to find out from either the social services in Virginia, the Department of Mental Health in Virginia, Central State in Virginia. And I'm committed to seeing whether or not there's a way that we can help her to reconnect with her lost brother of the last 25 years or so. So that's one. The other one, which is also very interesting to me, came from the actor Blair Underwood and his family. Blair Underwood did a segment with Skip Gates from Harvard on Who Do You Think You Are? And so we got calls from the television network asking whether or not we could confirm whether his grandfather had been a patient in this hospital. And my response was, I could, but I can't. And so when the program aired that evening, it became very clear that Blair Underwood had a grandfather to have been in this hospital as well. Subsequent to that,
I got calls from Blair Underwood's relatives in California. I got calls from Blair Underwood's family that still lives in the community where the hospital is located, because they also want to piece together some of this information as well. So it's an extraordinary project, again, in that it allows for relatives to be able to identify information. There's a group called the African American Genealogical History and Society, I can't remember the last part of the name. They held their conference in Richmond this past year in November, and I was one of the presenters. And so I held a workshop for about 50, 60 people, all of whom want to use genealogy as a means of accessing information about their relatives that may have, in fact, been a patient within the hospital. So I was able to connect them to the existing staff in that hospital that can allow them access to the records of their relatives. So I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of interest. We've had newspaper stories, we've had a few radio stories, and each time that something like that is aired, we get either telephone calls, emails, some effort by individuals to contact us looking for a lost relative. So for the portion of the project that Pat Galloway, Laurie Dung, and some others are actually working on, I think in time that's maybe going to be, with the descendants, one, if not the most important part of this project. When we've had any kind of a public meeting, we always invite people from the Dinwiddie County Historical Society, because that's the group that's located in the county where the hospital is located. And they've been very clear. They don't believe that this project is worthwhile unless it opens up greater access for descendants.
Okay. I said in the car on the way here, this would be the first question that I asked you, but it slipped my mind.
That's okay.
So if you could just please give our listeners a sense of who you are, where you come from, and maybe key milestones in your own life that kind of put you on the trajectory that you've been on since you rose to prominence in academe.
I was born in a small town in Arkansas in 1942. I'm now 74 years old. My parents and most of my grandparents were all born in Arkansas. In probably years past, all of my relatives were slaves in Arkansas. Some had been slaves in Tennessee, and part of our history takes us back to Virginia as well. But during the 1930s, my family, because of the loss of jobs, started to migrate to Tulsa, Oklahoma. After I was born, my dad was in the military, and my mother left the little Arkansas town where we were and went to live with her mother and grandparents in Tulsa, Oklahoma, until my father got out of the service. When my father left the service, they divorced, and so my brother, one brother that I had, and my mother lived with my grandparents in Tulsa, Oklahoma, probably from about 1944 until I left there to go to college in 1960. I've made periodic visits back and forth to the place where I'm from, because I love genealogy, but that was my earlier life. I graduated from high school in 1960 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and decided that I would go to college and that I would, in fact, be an accountant. I had lots of interest in finance at the time and decided that that would be my course. Colleges and universities in Oklahoma were still segregated in 1960 for the most part, and I decided that I really didn't want to be one of the earlier pioneers to fight segregating and desegregating schools. And so I got accepted to a small school in Fresno, California, where my grandmother and grandfather had migrated, Fresno State College. I was also a musician at that time period. I don't like to tell people that, but it's true.
Really?
And my desire was to go to California with a small band that I had and become a musician, rather than really going on and finishing college. The parents of all of the other guys who were in the band that I was in had other ideas. And so I ended up in California by myself. And I left Los Angeles after a few days, went up to Fresno, and started college as an accounting major at Fresno State College. After probably a year and a half, I got very interested in mental health in my psychology classes. I took abnormal psych, and it just seemed to me that there was something about this that I found very, very interesting. And what was very interesting was I started to learn more about psychopathology
And I put it in the context of people in the neighborhood, the segregated neighborhood in Oklahoma, where I grew up. And it just made it very clear to me that mental illness was always part of the neighborhoods in which I lived. However, most of the people in the neighborhood where I lived, regardless of their mental health status, stayed in the neighborhood, except a few. There was a woman next door who had epilepsy. I didn't know what that was, really. People called it having spells. And she ended up in a place called Taft State Hospital. The barber who lived a few doors away, who was Native American, had a strange proclivity for raising chain link fences in the neighborhood every 6, 10, 12 months or so. And you could hear him in the neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the morning with a jack clinking up the chain link fences in the neighborhood. He also went off to Taft State Hospital. And as I started to learn more about mental health, I learned a lot more about what the possible diagnoses were of some of the people in my own family or people in my neighborhood. And I became really personally fascinated with, so why did they go off to the state hospital? And why did so few persons go off to the state hospital? How long did they stay there? What was it like? And so I started really to get far more interested in the mental health side than I did in accounting or history or anything of the sort. And I then shifted over to psychology as a minor, sociology as a minor, French, and then social work as my major. And I did that for the next 4 years. Decided that I would get a master's degree because I had done my what they call field placements in mental health settings. I work for the California Bureau of Social Work, and my particular area was working with Spanish language people who had problems of severe mental illness who had been in state mental institutions. And I didn't speak any Spanish, and most of them didn't speak any English. So that opened up another door for me of why in the world would there be people like myself who spoke not one word of Spanish, working with family members and patients who didn't speak a word of English. So I enlisted my Spanish musician friends in another band that I was working with to be my interpreters. And it raised for me a lot of issues about culture and language. So when I entered the master's program, I was placed at Agnew State Hospital in San Jose, California. That became my place of residence for almost 2 years. And so I really got deeply involved and interested. After being at that hospital for 2 years, graduating in 1966, I was called by the United States Army. And I was unable to convince them that it was better for me to stay at San Jose than to join the Army. So I joined the Army as a second lieutenant and got stationed in San Antonio, Texas, at Brooke Army Hospital. Spent a relatively brief period of time there, and then spent the remainder of my tour of services, 4 years, at Fort Dix, New Jersey, directing a psychiatric unit in a military hospital. After that, I went to Brandeis University, worked with some persons who I thought were just extraordinary in the field of mental health and violence, and then went to back to the state of Virginia as director of mental health. That's my history.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, Dr. King Davis, I'm sorry that we don't have all the time in the world to pick your brain about all the doings in the world of mental health and in politics and policy making. That I know that you have more than a few thoughts on, and so I very much appreciate you taking the time to indulge us to this extent. So thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Ike. I really appreciated coming back to Hogg, and I would really appreciate the questions and comments that you've had today.